We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
I'm WILL-TV Program Director David Teal, and I'm your guest host for the 10 o'clock hour of Focus 580. This morning, we'll be taking your questions about personal finance. Joining us, as he often does, is David Sinnoh, a clinical professor of finance in the College of Business and director of the Office of Risk Management and Insurance Research at the University of Illinois. We'll be taking, as I said, your personal finance questions. The number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the area, anywhere in the U.S., use our toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And David, this is David. It's the old David hour. We were just talking a moment ago about whether there's been talk about the recession and whether it's over, and where do we stand with all of that?
Well, I'm going to cover a little bit of that in my introductory remarks, but I'm going to start talking just a bit about the stock market. And obviously, good morning, and of course, it's always a genuine pleasure to be with the listeners of WILL. As I said, I'm going to begin this little brief presentation with an analysis. Well, let's start with our couch potato portfolio, which can be accessed generally on the WILL website. However, I know we've had a little bit of technical difficulty, and WILL is working very, very hard to update the portfolio because I believe the last numbers that are on the website are back in May. So hopefully that problem will be solved in the next few days. Our apologies. In any event, our portfolio does consist of 8 stock indexes, which really represent the dominant themes, the dominant asset classes of the U.S. and the international markets. In terms of an overall asset allocation, approximately 30% of our couch potato portfolio is comprised of international stocks, wide, wide swath of big international stocks, small international stocks, as well as the emerging markets. And that leaves 70% in a variety of asset classes in U.S. stocks. Now, through last night's close, the total return for the couch potato portfolio year-to-date is about 28.5%. Concurrently, our benchmark, and that, of course, is the S&P 500 index, that's returned just north of 20% year-to-date. Now, this is a substantial turnaround for the portfolio. As some of you may recall, in the doldrums of the early spring, our portfolio and probably our listeners' portfolios were actually down some 20% or more. Similarly, most stock market investors have been pleased with the current direction of the market and thereby recovering about one-third of the overall money lost in the markets over the past 2 years. So while we've had this tremendous run-up, in many cases 25, 30, even 45%, the truth of the matter is if we take a look back over the last couple of years, if you started with a dollar, most investors still have, well, they don't have 50 cents anymore, but maybe they have 60 to 65 cents back on that dollar. And also, in 2009, this year, diversification is actually working. That's a good sign, because in 2008, it didn't matter where you tried to hide, where you tried to diversify, almost everything was heading south. So now we're moving back into a market where diversification does work, as our diversified couch potato portfolio, of course, is outperforming our benchmark S&P by about 8%. So it does make some sense to be in large companies, small companies, real estate investment trusts, emerging markets, etc., as opposed just to the dominating largest 500 companies traded on the U.S. stock exchanges. In fact, each component of the portfolio is outperforming the S&P 500 with only one exception, and that being the large value component of our portfolio. So, this December, it's going to be very, very likely that it will be important to rebalance your portfolio. For example, in this particular year, Whatever you invested in the emerging markets, at least thus far, you've been handsomely rewarded because the emerging markets index is up about 60+% for this year. And that may well throw out the overall balance of your portfolio. So it's going to be important to go back and take a look at some of these positions and say, gee, what a wonderful thing that it has grown, but has it grown a little bit too much? And should I shave some of those profits and reinvest in some of those other asset classes that have underperformed relative to some others? So we have a rebalancing function that is likely to take place in December. Well, I guess the $64,000 question, there used to be a game show, I believe, by that name. That dates me. Can the stock market rally continue? And if so, for how long, or will we experience another gut-wrenching pullback? Obviously, if we ask 100 economic pundits, well, I think we'll receive 100 different answers. And as you know, I generally do not predict the day-to-day, week-to-week, or even year-to-year direction of the stock markets. But I continue to articulate the position, I continue to hammer this position home, that a properly diversified stock portfolio held over long periods of time is an important piece of your investment puzzle. And additionally, at least part of our economic landscape is becoming a bit clearer. First, consumer confidence is just starting to tick up. If you look at the trend over the last 3 to 4 months, it's starting to tick up, although this is certainly not reflected as yet in retail sales and may indeed not be reflected, even though we have increased consumer confidence. Secondly, consumers are very concerned about their debts. We know this. And they are paying them down, especially their massive credit card debt and the savings rate, which used to be about delta zero, delta neutral, is now in about that 4% range of income. This is unprecedented. You have to go back over 30 years to see this kind of savings rate among the American public. Well, if you're saving your money, you're not spending your money. If you're not spending your money, you're not consuming goods. And if you're not consuming goods, businesses are not going to produce more inventory and hire more people. So in one sense, it's great to pay down debt because ultimately that will improve things. That will give an investor, it will give a consumer the confidence to go out and buy new cars, buy new durable goods, and even do more day-to-day shopping. So that's a little bit of a mixed bag, but in the long run, improving our savings certainly is a good thing. Housing prices, they're beginning to stabilize. And if you noticed, interestingly enough, there were new housing starts were actually up over the last couple of months. Why in the world could that be? I think we can trace a great deal of the home sales and a great deal in the spur of this activity to the $8,000 tax credit available to first-time homebuyers. This stimulus program, while enormously successful, in fact, many folks feel that maybe 400,000 to even 500,000 units of homes have been sold basically as a result of this incentive, this $8,000 tax credit. Well, it's already estimated to cost the federal government some $10 billion in lost tax revenue. That's $10 billion that is going on to our federal trillion-dollar deficit. The program, of course, is politically popular. Love those programs that are politically popular. At least Congress people love them. And there is additional support and growing support for extending the program, certainly beyond the November 30th deadline. And there is actually a bill and talk winding its way through committee that is suggesting that we should increase the tax credit from $8,000 to $15,000. And it doesn't matter if you're a first-time home buyer or not. Can you imagine? David, you and I will be eligible perhaps for a $15,000 tax credit if we decide to move. This is an attempt to spur the prices of homes between that $100,000 and $300,000 category. Most people who are taking advantage of that $8,000 tax credit, first-time home buyers, are buying in that $90,000 to $150,000 range. So we're now trying to move that up. At least that's the talk. It is tremendously supported and lobbied at the moment by the National Realtors Association. It's just the lobby pressure is just incredible on congresspeople. Simultaneously, interest rates remain at near historic lows, thanks to aggressive action by our government. In other words, it's actually a very good time to borrow money for a home, for your family business, or even a car, and these are all positive signs for our economy. Of course, I'd be remiss if I don't point out at least two of the more troubling aspects within our economy, which are inhibiting our recovery. First, while interest rates are indeed low, home buyers and small business owners are finding it enormously difficult to obtain a loan. In fact, financial institutions are demanding very high credit scores. We're talking 740 plus, down payments of 20 to 30% on a home. And in fact, 5 out of every 10 borrowers are turned down who are looking for a home. And the other 5 have to jump through inordinate hoops to obtain mortgage financing. I know there are 100 stories out there because I was one of those stories, had pretty decent credit. I'm a fairly reasonable person. And even I don't remember how many hoops, but David, it was a ton of hoops just to do a little bit of a refinancing on a piece of real estate. Also, of the 50% of borrowers who are approved, almost all of these loans end up with the government. How is that possible? Well, these loans get purchased by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. And if you'll recall, 80% of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which used to be sort of a quasi-private mortgage organization, well, that's owned by us. That's owned by us now, the federal government, when we did part of the massive bailout. In other words, the federal government is basically responsible for the uptick in housing, and most analysts are very fearful, including myself, then any economic recovery will certainly be dead in its tracks if the Fed withdraws its credit support. If you can't get credit, you can't go out and buy, you can't consume, there's not going to be inventory produced, and that means jobs are dead in the water. Secondly, can we truly have a robust economic recovery without real job growth? And that's where I'm hung up. In spite of recent positive signs, our economy is still basically shedding jobs. Reported unemployment is basically 10%. I heard just on WILL that Indiana dropped to 9.9 from 10.6. All right, it mirrors the country. And if we look at California and Michigan, it's god-awful in some of those states. But we know that if we include the underemployed folks who are not working at their true level of education and ability, and we include the people who have simply given up looking for a job, then that number is much, much higher. And economists have estimated that number as high as 14, maybe 15% of a 95 million workforce in the United States. That's a lot of folks who are hurting in this country. It seems to me, until we see increasing real job growth for at least one calendar quarter, I want to see it for 3 consecutive months or feel comfortable it's going to happen for 3 consecutive months, it would be my view that housing prices will remain just about at their current levels. They're not going to dramatically increase. And our economic growth will be very anemic. So thinking between the lines, if you're trying to interpolate what I'm saying, am I looking for another massive run-up in the stock market? No, I'm not at the moment. I think we're getting fairly close to that top. Does that mean we should sell stocks? No. Stocks are a long-term hold. They are an important part of your overall economic and diversified strategy. So there you have it, David. Those are some of my thoughts on the economy, the stock market, etc. Be delighted to take calls on these issues or any other listeners on what are on our listeners' minds.
Well, thanks. I mean, you know, and that really helps kind of catch me up to date because this is an area that I, you know, a lot of it kind of goes past me, and so it's nice to have it explained in just such a coherent manner. We've got several callers already lined up here. Let's talk first. We've got a caller who's been very patient from St. Joseph on line one. St. Joseph?
Good morning. Several months ago, I attended a seminar at the U of I Extension office talking about finances and so forth. And actually, David, you were one of the presenters. And they are recommending to use CD Ladder for emergency funds. And prior to that, I always retained our emergency funds and our money market fund. In fact, I have all our taxable and non-taxable accounts at Vanguard. So I've retained that money market fund just for convenience after purchasing the CD ladder. But now I'm beginning to question if it's worth the $20 per year fee because of the low balance. And I'm thinking about canceling that account. So I just wondered if I'm missing something and wanted to have your recommendation regarding retaining or eliminating that money market fund.
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you have a minimum of $3,000 in that fund?
In what fund?
In the Vanguard Prime Money Market Fund?
I have less. No.
Oh, okay. That's the reason. That's the reason.
Right.
And if you're going to keep less than that in the Vanguard Prime Money Market Fund, then it's tough to make a good argument to keep it, and you might as well be in a bank money market fund.
Yeah.
Okay? But as far as a strategy with fixed income to do a CD ladder, that makes some sense. That makes some sense. And if you took advantage of it as a result of those extension meetings, you actually are probably in certificates of deposit currently, which are significantly higher than when you have those CDs mature and start looking again. So you've probably done all right in that CD ladder.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, makes good sense.
So you do recommend just go ahead and closing that account.
Well, I don't have a problem with that unless you were going to put more money into it and you were going to utilize it to move into other index funds, for example. But if you're not, then it's one less hassle, it's one less problem, and certainly you don't want to be in a money market account where you're getting debited on that account.
Yeah, right. Okay, great. I'm glad to see you. I'm not missing something. Appreciate your guidance. I enjoyed your analysis this morning.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for your call. We've got another caller right now from Urbana on line two. Urbana?
Is it my turn?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Good morning.
Morning. My question is about IRAs. I have two questions. I heard it said that you should not put your rollover IRA into your trust or your Roth IRA into your trust. And then I've also heard that there will be new rules about withdrawals and possibly different amounts than is required now for to take out.
Okay. Those are great questions. First of all, when you have an IRA, whether it is a traditional IRA, a rollover IRA, a Roth IRA, within that IRA document, you designate a primary and secondary beneficiary. So whomever you designate as that beneficiary at your death, then that beneficiary is entitled to that money. It does not go through a probate system. It passes directly by operation of law. So as a result, most people with their IRAs designate an individual for the distribution of those IRA funds. Now, that distributee may have certain options of how they're going to take the money, but that's a different issue. So it's for ease and convenience, it is generally recommended that IRA beneficiaries are individuals. Sometimes, for example, they are charities. But whomever you name, that money passes directly by operation of law to that named distributee. Now, if you take your IRA and the beneficiary of your IRA is your trust, then the money does pour into the trust, but there can be an adverse income tax consequence depending upon how the trust document is written and depending upon who the beneficiaries are. So there is a negative possibility that the ultimate people or individuals that you want to see end up with that IRA could have an unwanted and unnecessary income tax consequence based upon how this thing is set up. So that is the major reason that we generally have beneficiaries either as individuals or as a charity.
Well, I have three children that are beneficiaries.
Okay, that's the way you want to do it. That's the way you want to do it. If you have three children, have you made each of them one-third, one-third,
yes,
and one-third?
Yes.
Okay, that probably is one possibility. Another idea that some people do, if you want to do some advanced planning, is you actually break that IRA, whether it's a Roth or a traditional, into three separate IRAs. And you name each individual IRA with a separate beneficiary. There's an advantage in that because when an individual passes away, then the beneficiary can perhaps, under certain rules, take the remaining IRA money over their lifetime. They can take it outright, or sometimes they can amortize it over a 60-month period of time, 1 year at a time. But if you have all the beneficiaries commingled together, they all have to do the same thing. All right? They all have to agree to do the same thing, which means if one of them wants to take all the money and pay the income tax, then the other two are going to find themselves in that circumstance.
Exactly.
Yeah. So if you have three children, one who is extraordinarily wealthy who doesn't want the money, and one who is very, very poor who desperately needs the money, then you may have set yourself up for a situation where all of the money is going to be taxed because the desperately poor child needs to take the money. Understand?
Yes.
Okay, that's number one. Question number two, are there going to be new rules about withdrawals? Well, of course, as you probably know, in 2009, because so many folks lost so much money in the stock market, they said, wait a second. We don't want to take money out of our retirement programs. We don't want to take money out of our IRAs if we're 70 and a half or older under these minimum distribution rules. So Congress, based upon politics and maybe some good economic theory, but mostly on politics, wanting to get reelected, say, hey, why don't we give folks a reprieve? They don't have to take money out of these programs in 2009 if they don't want to. So that's the 2009 rule. That's not been extended to 2010 as yet. What has changed in 2010 is that prior to 2010, if you wanted to roll money into a Roth IRA, IRA money, 401k money, into a Roth IRA, that in order to be eligible to do that, your income, exclusive of what you were going to roll, had to be $100,000 or less. So that income limit has been essentially reduced. It's been changed. It says it's no more. It doesn't matter whether you make $1 million a year or $2.50. If you want to roll money into a Roth IRA from a traditionally tax-deferred vehicle, that's okay.
I can do that now?
You can do that in 2010.
In 2010.
But when you do it in 2010 and you roll it into a Roth IRA, if you are rolling tax-deferred money, remember that the amount that you roll is going to be subject to immediate federal income tax.
Oh.
So if you had $20,000 in a traditional IRA and you want to put it in a Roth, okay, I'm going to put it in a Roth. It's now sitting in a Roth, but I've got a report on my federal income tax return, that $20,000. Understand?
So the money that you take out of the traditional IRA and put it into the Roth IRA, if it's $20,000, then you have to pay the tax on that.
Right, because it's been deferred all those years and you've never paid tax on it.
Oh.
And you and I know that our wonderful government, which is us, wants to get their grimy, greedy little hands on our money.
Yes.
Because they need it based upon these trillion-dollar deficits that are coming down the pike.
So what's your... Is it better to do that, or
well,
is it
certainly
better to keep it in the regular Roth?
Well, here's... Now, I know you're about 40 years young.
Uh-huh.
So at 40 years young, I would recommend moving money from traditional IRAs into Roths because I firmly believe that ultimately, even though I hate to say it, income tax rates are going to go up. I think it's inevitable. So I'd rather pay the taxes now and then not have to pay the taxes in the future on Roth money.
Mm-hmm.
For people who are older, it's a different issue, and I would consult my CPA because CPAs have software, and they can look at it for you right on their tax software to see whether or not it makes sense.
Okay, well, I'm 80 years old.
I know that you're not exactly 40, but you think like 40. So that's the good thing. Now, the other thing to remember is that when you roll money from a traditional IRA to a Roth, you don't have to roll it all at once.
Uh-huh.
You could roll $5,000 a year to lessen the tax bite.
Mm-hmm.
Understand?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure, Joan, visiting with you, and have a wonderful weekend.
Well, you too. And is there any printed information about all this?
Well, I think you can read it, of course, if you can understand the legal lease in the IRS regulations, but if you Google IRS regs on rollover IRAs, Roth IRAs. You'll find it in there. You'll find it in there.
IRAs, regulations, and what?
For Roth IRAs and traditional IRAs.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you very much, David.
My pleasure.
Bye.
Well, thank you so much for your call. And just for folks who have tuned in late, I'm David Thiel. We're here talking with David Sinnoh, who's the director of the Office of Risk Management and Insurance Research at the University of Illinois, taking your personal finance questions. And we've already got several other callers who've been waiting patiently, so let's get right to it. Line 3 in Champaign, good morning. Thanks for your patience.
Good morning. I'd like to ask for your reactions or comments about an article which I read this morning in the Wall Street Journal. I don't know if you've read it. It's by someone named Brett Ahrens, and it talks about the title is "The Dow Will Hit 10,000 Soon, So What?" And there's a number of points he makes that I'll sort of encapsulate and then see what you have to say, because this is essentially about whether this is a good time to buy or buy more than just whatever you're buying
on a regular basis.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the first comment he makes is that the first time the Dow hit 10,000 was in March 99, and though it might hit 10,000 now, because the dollar has lost 23% of its purchasing power, it really is as if the Dow is only hitting 7,500. So that's the first point he makes. The second point he makes is that the earnings forecast now is not very good, and that the dividend yield, as he puts it, is at 2.1%.
Correct.
And that U.S. market overall is nearly 17 times likely earnings, whereas
historically, right.
Average is maybe mm-hmm.
13, 14, exactly.
Okay.
You're preaching to the choir so far.
So based on this, the question is, are stocks attractive as long-term investments? And his one final point, which I'll just, and then I'll, he says, shares don't get better as they go higher, they get worse. A share is just a claim on future dividends. The more you pay, the worse the deal. That's a quote.
Understood.
So,
understood. So what's my reaction to all of that?
That's right.
I think the most important thing he's pointing out is price-earnings ratios,
mm-hmm.
because ultimately stocks revert to their means. And historically, mm-hmm. stocks have sold at 13 or 14, maybe 15, even though they might go lower and they might go significantly higher. 14, 15 is sort of a norm
mm-hmm.
for stocks on price-earnings ratios. And earnings are the big issue.
Yep.
When are earnings going to recover? I don't see earnings particularly recovering in the next month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months. This is going to be an elongated process. So are stocks cheap today? No, stocks are not cheap. Are they fairly valued? Well, we'll have to remains to be seen, because that is a function of earnings. And right now, the way corporations are eking out earnings is they continue to let people go. That's really what's happening. They're not increasing sales. Sales are actually dropped 15-20% for many of these companies, and they've made it up, obviously, by dropping employees, long-term employees, middle-class employees, and that, of course, has had a great deal to do with the massive unemployment rate that we're still facing. So here is my advice. I am a dollar-cost averager, all right? I am not a market timer. He's sounding a little bit like a market timer in the sense that, hey, things are expensive now. Put on the brakes. Stop buying. My feeling is that you buy over a lifetime, that you figure out what your allocation is going to be, and then very, very slowly each month you work toward that allocation. And as if you accumulate more money, you continue to invest month after month after month. But I agree in this sense, I certainly wouldn't throw a lot of money at the stock market today, especially since it's being priced at 17 times future earnings, and those earnings are suspect, let's face it. They're based upon a continued mini recovery in the stock market. So I'm not really disagreeing with what he's saying, other than to say, as an individual investor, I still believe that stocks are good over a long period of time, and that it is a continuing process, a continuing investment tradition that we have to continue to stay with, a continued discipline, if you will.
So should one change one's allocation now and put more into bonds and fixed incomes rather than into stocks?
Well, that depends on what you're comfortable with, all right? And everyone's asset allocation is different. But most people underestimate the amount of stocks that they really need because they have either other income, Social Security income, pension income, some other kind of income. I feel pretty comfortable. I feel very comfortable with a 50-50 asset allocation today. Okay, that's just what I'm telling you. Most of my clients are between 40 and 50% equities and 40 to 60% fixed income. But for the most part, at least 40% equities and some as high as 50% equities. And I don't see paring that down at the moment.
Okay. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Hey, thank you very much. And we have a caller who's been waiting for a good long time from Belgium. Belgium, on line four.
Hello, and good morning to you all.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Sinnoh. I've got a couple of 3 points that I'd like to point out to you, and if I might. First off, you talked about unemployment. And unemployment, the figures we see are really not truly indicative of what's out here. Number one, yes, there's a lot of people out of work, but a great deal of businesses, many, many businesses, have taken and furloughed their people, working 3 days a week, 2 days a week, cutting back hours in different ways. Now, it's not unemployment, but it is reduced income, which has the same effect as unemployment. And that's something that was not reported at all to anybody. So that was the first point I wanted to add on to your unemployment aspects and your savings aspects, because if you're not making, if you're making 25% less or 20% less or whatever it may be, you're not going to be saving as much as you used to.
And you're right. And those are slightly reflected in underemployment. In other words,
exactly.
Underemployment is similar to furloughing and actually taking a position for less money. Okay?
Exactly. The next point I wanted to point out to you is I totally understand your diversification ideas with stock market. But if you're involved in the stock market, even in a diversified way, you do follow it a little bit. And every now and again, you see a gem in the rough. And this spring, General Electric got down to $6 a share.
Absolutely.
General Electric usually runs about $16 a
mm-hmm.
share.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, it's just about $15.
Mm-hmm.
Little extra income, a little extra money I had, I put a little bit in there. I made a substantial amount of money.
And good for you.
You know,
I'm very happy for you.
Yeah, so occasionally, you can find those little rough gems that really work out well, and you should look for them.
No question. And all I'm saying is that when I publicly speak, it's very, very difficult for me to pick out individual stocks and suggest them, especially if I hold positions through mutual funds in those stocks. That creates a problem for me. But again, I have no problem with someone who is a savvy investor to take a look at a disciplined strategy and follow certain stocks and say, look, those stocks are selling well below their means, and things ultimately revert back to the mean. So why not step in at $6? I applaud you.
And last, this summer into June, I went up and did a little fishing at the on the Tuolumne just below the Hetch Hetchy Dam. It was a tremendous time. Caught some nice trout. Had a great time.
Well, you'll have to email me about that because you and I share that joy of fishing.
You've never done that?
Not at that particular place. The last fishing I did was in northern Wisconsin last weekend. I got up there for just a couple of days, took some friends up with my spouse, and fortunately put one of the gentlemen on a nice muskie.
Oh.
And was about a 45-inch, 18-pound fish. Brought it up to the side of the boat, looked at it, and said to the gentleman, no, we can't bring it into the boat. We don't do that. This is catch and release. Now, sort of, you know, drag your pole or do something, you know, flick your rod so that hook comes out. And I thought he was going to cry, but he didn't. And he was a good sport, and he was very happy.
Good day to you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. And, yeah, we're just to remind you, we are talking this morning with David Sinnoh, who is our resident expert on personal finance and occasionally fishing. We're, of course, taking your questions, and we have several more callers lined up here. So let's go right on to line one in Glenwood. Line one.
Yes, hello. I tuned in late, so I'm not sure this is your jurisdiction, but I got a couple questions. The scenario is something like this. My mother is selling her house for approximately $160,000. After she sells the house, she'd like to gift her 10 grandchildren and 4 children $10,000 apiece. So my questions are, number one, will she have an impact of negative tax liability if she sells her house at $160,000? Does she have to pay tax? And two, will she suffer a negative tax impact by giving $10,000 apiece to her grandchildren and children?
Okay, those are wonderful questions. First of all, let me ask you, how long has your mother lived in the house? Has she lived in it 2 consecutive years over the last 5?
36 years.
Okay. Here's the bottom line. A single taxpayer is entitled to a $250,000 break, a profit, with no tax being owed on a personal residence when you sell, so long as sometime during the past 5 years you have lived 2 consecutive years in that personal residence. So your mom basically could sell that house for a whole lot more, and she has no state or federal income tax impact. So that's good news number one. All right. Good news number two is that in 2009, most people think that you can gift $10,000 to anybody you want, children, grandchildren, in fact, me, as a matter of fact. The actual rule is $13,000. So $10,000 of gifts to each of these children, there is no gift tax on the donor, your mother, and no gift tax on the donee, the children and the grandchildren. Now, when the children and grandchildren take that $10,000 and reinvest it, maybe in a certificate of deposit down at the bank, and earn interest, or maybe in a stock, and receive a dividend, that interest and those dividends are taxable, but not the capital itself. So what a wonderful thing to have happen for the benefit of the children and the grandchildren. They're going to receive this money totally tax-free, and your mother can gift it totally tax-free, and she doesn't have to worry about any income tax impact on the sale of her personal residence.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sure everyone will be happy all around to hear that. You said the number, magic number, was $13,000 then.
Exactly. So maybe you can gross her up to 13 instead of 10,000. I don't know. Well, and if there's anything left over, I spell my last name S-I-N-O-W.
I see.
Okay.
No looking a gift horse in the mouth, even if it's your mother.
Absolutely. So kudos to your mom.
Thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye. A pleasure.
Well, thank you for your call. We have about 13 minutes left in the program, so let's go right on to the next call. We've got line 2 on Champaign. Line 2, good morning.
Good morning. I just recently read the latest Consumer Reports financial newsletter, and it had an interesting suggestion in it, and that is to take a 403B account and roll it over into an IRA, and then next year take the tax hit and convert that to a Roth IRA. What do you think of that idea, as opposed to just simply waiting until age 70 and a half and taking the required minimum distributions?
Well, it depends really on your individual tax situation. Now, clearly, in order to be able to roll a 403B account into an IRA, you are currently required not to be a contributing employee into that 403B. So is my caller still in the air?
Yes, I am. We are the situation is a retired couple in
okay.
50s, early 60s.
Okay, fine. So you are retired. So as a result, you have the absolute right to roll that money tax deferred into a rollover IRA. All right. At that point in time, you can make a decision in 2010, do I want to go further and roll some or all of that money into a Roth IRA? To the extent that you roll some or all of that money into a Roth IRA, you're going to create taxable income. But then, once, of course, it's sitting in the Roth IRA, it is totally tax-free, at least under current law, and there are no minimum distribution requirements. So what I'm recommending to a lot of my clients is rather than rolling all of the money over, is to do it over a series of years, talking with your certified public accountant or your tax preparer, and just simply rolling over enough of those dollars so that you are not increasing your marginal income tax rate. So if you're in a current 25% tax rate and you could throw another $8,000 at that rate, at that 25% rate, then let's roll over $8,000 into our Roth. I don't want to get into a situation where I'm rolling money and creating a higher marginal tax rate. So that would be a potential strategy for someone who is considering rolling money from an IRA into a Roth IRA. Does that help?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay. My pleasure.
Well, we've got about 10 minutes left in the program, and we've got one caller still on the line. So I think it's time to give out the phone numbers again. If you'd like to ask a personal finance question with our guest, David Sinnoh, please call our toll-free line at 800-222-9455, or in the Champaign-Urbana area, you can call us at 333-9455. And we've got a caller on line three from Morton Grove. Good morning.
Morning. I'd like to ask, if I may, a question of how I might protect myself, or I should say my purchasing power, if I'm planning to, which I am, a visit to Europe next year. And if the time permits, I'll ask a second question, but I don't want to interfere with your program.
You're asking a mighty tough question, and that is the relationship between the euro and the dollar. And a lot of folks thought that the dollar was going to actually firm over the last 6 months against the euro, and they played their cards that way, and lo and behold, it went the other way. And that is, you would have been much better off 6 months ago to buy those euros and protect yourself as the dollar continues to fall against the euro. I really don't have a good feeling one way or the other. I'm not an expert in that area, so I hesitate to give you my two cents on it. I think there's going to be a trading range, and whether the dollar strengthens or weakens, I'm just not certain to what level that's going to take place. So your guess, frankly, is as good as mine. Most economists 6 months ago would have told you that the dollar was going to actually become stronger against the euro, and it turned out just the other way. So I'm not certain that you really can hedge that risk. But all you could do is you could figure out and say, look, I'd rather be half right or half wrong. So you could figure out what you are going to spend in Europe over the period of time that you're going to be there, and then say, gee, in American dollars, I'm going to spend $5,000. So maybe you take half that expense and you convert half that expense to euros. That's a possibility. So at least you're half right. It's sometimes the advice that I give to people who own a stock, and they're waffling, should I buy, should I sell? And they're worried about buying more, selling more. And I said, well, better to be half right. So if you're going to sell the stock, sell half.
Okay.
All right? So I think that would be my advice.
And I did want to ask you a question concerning the fact that over the years, I have mingled after-tax dollars with IRAs into my larger IRA account, all traditional.
Okay.
With some post-tax dollar IRAs, which I had separately, but I've recently pulled them together into it. What sort of trouble am I headed for with that, if any at all?
Well, obviously that was not a particularly good thing to do.
Okay.
What you need to do is you need to go back and make certain that you have very, very clean and clear records. That's number one. Did you do this just recently? Within the last 45 days, for example?
Yes.
All right. What I would do is immediately consult with my tax advisor. Do you have a tax advisor?
Yes.
And you may be able to reverse that process. And I would consider strongly doing that and keeping these amounts segregated. It is so much easier. Is it the kiss of death? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Don't lose sleep over it. But it can be remedied either through re-establishing the original positions in those original accounts or having very, very good records so that you can keep good sub-accounting records in the event that you're ever audited.
Okay, I guess there's still time if I've done something in the last 45 days.
Yeah, yeah. Take a look at it and move on it right away and get together with your accountant.
Yes, okay. Well, thank you once again, Doctor. A wonderful show.
My pleasure.
And thank you for your call. We've got about 5.5 minutes left and a couple of callers on the line, so let's go right to line one in Urbana. Good morning.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi there.
I'm so pleased you took my call. I have a question that regards maybe gifting and Roth IRAs. The people involved is myself. I'm retired, and I have a child who's 21, and this year, may have made, $3,000 or less dollars this year due to going to school and that sort of thing.
Yes.
But what I want to achieve here is to get a small Roth IRA out of my name and into the child's name. It's only $1,300 at this point. And it'll mature in October.
So you have your Roth IRA currently in a certificate of deposit. That will mature in October.
Yes.
And are you over 59 and a half years of age?
Yes.
And have you had the Roth IRA set up for a minimum of 5 years?
Yes.
All right, then you are eligible to take any amount of money out of your Roth IRA that you so desire and pay no tax on it.
Okay.
That's number one.
Okay.
So now the money is in your checking account. It's not in a Roth IRA. It's just sitting there.
Yes.
Number two, if your child had income in 2009, and you're telling me that your child did,
yes,
it's approximately $3,000,
mm-hmm,
then you could fund on his benefit, for his benefit, a Roth IRA up to that entire amount, up to $3,000. So if you wanted to fund with this money that was in a CD, you most certainly can do that. The Roth IRA would be established in your child's name.
Yes.
It's your child's Roth IRA, your child's Social Security number.
Right. Okay.
And then what would be nice is your child, of course, would name you as the beneficiary.
Okay.
All right?
Uh-huh.
Okay. So that's all that it would take. And, yes, you're on the right track. And what a wonderful thing to do for a 21-year-old, yeah, so that money can grow tax-free forever.
That's the whole idea.
That is the whole idea. You're on the right track.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And we have about 3 minutes left and one more call. Well, actually, two people on the line. Line two from Champaign. Line two, good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I've got two quick questions. One is, I can't find the answer to this. It's 72T. You can take payments out for 5 years or 59 and a half, whichever is longer.
Correct.
And is it true that you can stop payments when you hit that period?
Generally, yes, if you've set it up correctly.
Okay, and we can't find the verbiage in the IRS docs to actually say you can stop payments.
What you need to do is, before you take any payments, is make certain that you work with your certified public accountant to set this up correctly. People make mistakes in the minimum distributions over that five-year amortizing period. So make certain that is calculated correctly.
And two, the question is, on a severance package, which was a great sum this year, the severance was paid in a lump sum, and 401k contributions naturally weren't being able to withdraw from a severance payout. My question is, on that severance payout only, am I able to do a 401k, solo 401k, for that severance money?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so. Have you already been paid the entire sum?
Yep.
And you had...
I couldn't
funds
contribute
that were withheld, and you really didn't have a choice. No, you really can't.
I wanted
go
with it. Yeah, I
you wanted it done, but you couldn't.
But they wouldn't do
right
it because you're no longer with the company.
Right. So you're not eligible to put that money into a 401k. What
right
other choices do you have? Well, one of the choices.
Unemployed.
Now you're unemployed. But did you, for example, have you fully funded your Roth IRA, or
No. Did
you get into a situation where you made too much money with the severance package to be eligible for a Roth IRA?
No.
Okay, so you want to make sure that you fund your Roth IRA as well. So do that at the very least.
How about a 401k to offset the income from the severance?
Can't do it. You're not employed, okay. Et cetera. So unless you have a new job. Unless you have a new job.
Yeah.
And then you could possibly take money from salary at your new job and put that in a 401k.
Okay. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. We maybe have time for one quick question from Danville on line four. Danville?
Yes. We've been gifting appreciated stock for our charitable giving the past few years. And, of course, now our stock isn't so appreciated. So we're looking for some alternatives that might be equally beneficial or at least close.
Well, one of the real benefits is if you have a paid-up life insurance policy. You have one of those where you're not paying anymore? Charities love to get paid-up life insurance policies where
okay.
they don't have to pay a premium and you've really leveraged your gift. Maybe the cash value of the gift is $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 and the death benefit is $75,000 or $100,000. So they have the choice of either cashing it in and taking the cash value but really waiting and then really leveraging that gift at someone's death. So that's a possibility. I'm being told that we're out of time.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
But a pleasure.
Thank you so much for your call. And, yep, we're going to have to leave it at that. Our guest for this last hour has been David Sinnoh. He's the clinical professor of finance in the College of Business and the director of the Office of Risk Management and Insurance Research at the University of Illinois. That's quite a title. Thank you, David, for explaining all of this to us. It's a very complicated subject. Thanks for coming in this morning.
It's always lots of fun.
Well, and we're certainly glad to have you. I was your guest host for this hour, David Thiel. There'll be another hour coming up in just a few minutes here with Focus 580. But first, we'll have news from NPR. And before that, a market update.
We know you have a lot of websites bookmarked. Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, let us suggest one more, willpledge.org. There you can make a donation toward the member match, $25, $50, or whatever. Like that video of the cat playing keyboards, you can pass this link on to your friends, and then they'll donate $25. Then someone else will stop by and donate $50 or whatever, and so on. Come October, we'll use that member match for our pledge drive. So give now at willpledge.org. We promise not to Rickroll you.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
We're checking out here and seeing the corn pit and keeping a close eye on it. It's showing weakness at the moment, but we would really like to see it finish to the plus side today. December corn up around 330 would be a positive sign as we would be closing out the week on a stronger note. However, not to be at the moment. December corn 324.5 is down 4.5. March 338.5 down 3.75. May 346.5 down 5. July 355.5 down 4.75. September of 2010, 364 down 4.75. October crude oil 71.91 down 56. October ethanol 162.5 is down a penny. October RBOB at 183.6 is down 1.5. November beans 953.